advertising revelations about bad food handling and unsavory industry-wide practices. Talking about why you probably shouldn't order fish on a Monday, why those who favor well-done get the scrapings from the bottom of the barrel, and why seafood frittata is not a wise brunch selection won't make me any more popular with potential future employers. My naked contempt for vegetarians, sauce-on-ciders, the lactose intolerant, and the cooking of the Ewok-like Emeril Lagasse is not going to get me my own show on the Food Network. I don't think I'll be going on ski weekends with Andre Soltner anytime soon or getting a back rub from that hunky Bobby Flay. Eric Repair won't be calling me for ideas on tomorrow's fish special. But I'm simply not going to deceive anybody about the life as I've seen it. It's all here. The good, the bad, and the ugly. The interested reader might, on one hand, find out how to make professional-looking and tasting plates with a few handy tools, and on the other hand, decide never to order the moule marinière again. Tant pis, man. For me, the cooking life has been a long love affair, with moments both sublime and ridiculous. But like a love affair, looking back, you remember the happy times best. The things that drew you in, attracted you in the first place. The things that kept you coming back for more. I hope I can give the reader a taste of those things and those times. I've never regretted the unexpected left turn that dropped me in the restaurant business, and I've long believed that good food, good eating is all about risk. Whether we're talking about unpasteurized Stilton, raw oysters, or working for organized crime associates, food, for me, has always been an adventure. Food is good. My first indication that food was something other than a substance one stuffed in one's face when hungry, like filling up at a gas station, came after fourth grade elementary school. It was on a family vacation to Europe, on the Queen Mary, in the cabin-class dining room. There's a picture somewhere, my mother in her Jackie O sunglasses, my younger brother and I in our painfully cute cruise wear, boarding the big Cunard ocean liner, all of us excited about our first transatlantic voyage, our first trip to my father's ancestral homeland, France. It was the soup. It was cold. This was something of a discovery for a curious fourth grader whose entire experience of soup to this point had consisted of Campbell's cream of tomato and chicken noodle. I'd eaten in restaurants before, sure, but this was the first food I really noticed. It was the first food I enjoyed, and more important, remembered enjoying. I asked our patient British waiter what this delightfully cool, tasty liquid was. Vichyssoise, came the reply. A word to this day, even though it's now a tired old warhorse of a menu selection and one I've prepared thousands of times, still has a magical ring to it. I remember everything about the experience, the way our waiter ladled it from a silver tureen into my bowl, the crunch of tiny chopped chives he spooned on as garnish, the rich, creamy taste of leek and potato, the pleasurable shock, the surprise that it was cold. I don't remember much else about the passage across the Atlantic. I saw Boeing Boeing with Jerry Lewis and Tony Curtis in the Queen's movie theater, and a Bardot flick. The old liner shuddered and groaned and vibrated terribly the whole way. Barnacles on the hull was the official explanation. And from New York to Cherbourg, it was like riding atop a giant lawnmower. My brother and I quickly became bored and spent much of our time in the teen lounge listening to House of the Rising Sun on the jukebox or watching the water slosh around like a contained tidal wave in the below-deck saltwater pool. But that cold soup stayed with me. It resonated, waking me up, making me aware of my tongue, and in some way preparing me for future events. My second pre-epiphany and my long climb to chefdom also came during that first trip to France. After docking, my mother, brother, and I stayed with cousins in the small seaside town of Cabourg, a bleak, chilly resort area in Normandy on the English Channel. The sky was almost always cloudy, the water was inhospitably cold. All the neighborhood kids thought I knew Steve McQueen and John Wayne personally. As an American, it was assumed we were all pals, that we hung out together on the range, riding horses and gunning down miscreants, so I enjoyed a certain celebrity right away. The beaches, while no good for swimming, were studded with old Nazi blockhouses and gun emplacements, many still bearing visible bullet scars and the scorch of flamethrowers, and there were tunnels under the dunes, all very cool for a little kid to explore. My little French friends were, I was astonished to find, allowed to have a cigarette on Sunday, were given watered vin ordinaire at the dinner table, and best of all, they owned Velo Solex motorbikes. This was the way to raise kids, I recall thinking, unhappy that my mother did not agree. So for my first few weeks in France, I explored underground passageways looking for dead Nazis, played miniature golf, sneaked cigarettes, and read a lot of Tintin and Asterix comics, scooted around on my friends' motorbikes, and absorbed little life lessons from observations that, for instance, the family friend Monsieur Dupont brought his mistress to some meals and his wife to others, his extended brood of children apparently indifferent to the switch. I was largely unimpressed.